Going back to William Bullitt. William Bullitt, who later, and we're going to see, became U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union. William Bullitt embarked on a more or less self-appointed diplomatic mission. He contacted Lenin. Now, bear in mind that in this time period, the fledgling Soviet Union had been invaded by 14 different nations. I've also heard it said 13. It depends on one's count. But in an attempt to reinstall the white government, again, as contrasted with the Reds, and to cast out the Bolsheviks, a number of different nations invaded the fledgling Soviet Union, including the United States, Japan, England, France, Poland. There were German troops who were involved, and others as well. It was in this time period when there was a brutal civil war going on in Russia, at that time Bolshevik Russia, that William Bullitt, and they were also, the reactionary forces were also supported by these troops from 14 different nations. William Bullitt contacted Vladimir Lenin, and they sat down, and they had a major parley. And it's interesting to contemplate of how different the history of our century would have been if the agreement that William Bullitt brokered with Lenin had been allowed to go through. Lenin basically agreed to freeze the political drawing line, so to speak, or the political boundary lines at the point at which they existed at this particular point in time. Most of the Ukraine, for example, would have remained outside of the Soviet Union and would have basically been an independent country and in all likelihood fiercely anti-communist. Much of the white or reactionary armies were to be allowed to hold some of the territory they held in areas like Siberia. And basically, Lenin had agreed to basically a non-confrontational stance with the West. It would have resulted in a much smaller and a much less militant Soviet Union. In all likelihood, there never would have been a Cold War, although who knows? Germany still probably would have invaded the Ukraine, and then after that, probably the Soviet Union, so who knows? But it would have left, for example, most of the Ukraine, which is one of the largest of the Soviet socialist republics, outside of the Soviet Union and firmly in control of fiercely anti-communist forces. Lenin agreed to this and a number of other things. However, when William Bullitt got back, even though Wilson was in favor of including the Soviet Union in the family of nations because, again, some of the Ivy League egotism or the elite egotism of some of these people figures prominently in the story because Wilson himself had not dispatched Bullitt on this mission. Bullitt had sort of undertaken this on his own initiative. And again, many of these people were careerists. Basically, Wilson nixed Bullitt's agreement with Lenin. The agreement, which Lenin had thought had come from Wilson himself, never went into effect. It's probable that the history of our century would have been a dramatically different state of affairs if that agreement had been allowed to hold. Probably would not have been a Cold War as we understand it, because again, so much of what we think of as the Soviet Union would not have been part of the Soviet Union, notably the Ukraine. However, William Bullitt's agreement did not stand, but it's worth understanding that these people were already, we're going to see most of these people cropping up during the course of the narrative. Now again, this is 1919. Remember the name DeWitt Poole. We're going to come back to him a little bit later. Now, in 1920, J.P. Morgan, Pierpont Morgan, the prominent industrialist and one of the major names in 19th and 20th century American capitalism, Pierpont Morgan dispatches Wild Bill Donovan, again, the much decorated and brash young officer from the Fighting 69th, to go to Europe and to basically reconnoiter the political situation in Europe. Some analysts have also maintained that at this period in time, J.P. Morgan also gave Donovan $1 million. Now, bear in mind, that was a lot of money in 1920. It's a decent chunk of change in 1997. But $1 million in 1920 was a fortune. It was much more than it is today. Some writers, some analysts have maintained that Morgan also gave Donovan $1 million to disseminate to reactionary political parties in Germany. Now, this is 1920, and already Wild Bill Donovan is engaged on a private intelligence mission for J.P. Morgan to size up the situation in Europe, which obviously was very much in flux at this point in time. And according to some analysts, Donovan also was given $1 million to dispatch to various German reactionary political parties. When Donovan gets home, the fee that he uses, the fee that he gets as his commission for this mission for J.P. Morgan is used by Wild Bill Donovan to found his own Wall Street law firm, Donovan Leisure Irvine, and I've forgotten who the fourth partner was in the original combine. Doesn't matter. It was not, although it was a prominent player, it was not as important as some of these other names like Carter Ledyard and Milburn and Sullivan and Cromwell. But it's important that already in 1920, Wild Bill is acting on behalf of Morgan in order to reconnoiter the situation in Europe and also, according to some analysts, to channel $1 million to reactionary political parties in Germany in order to tip the political balance. Bear in mind that, as I said earlier, John Foster Dulles and some of the other members of the American elite were already looking in 1919 to rebuild German industry in order to use Germany as a mainspring of anti-communism in Europe. And again, this is 1919. Now, one of the provisions of the Versailles Treaty was that Germany was to assume the guilt for World War I. That was, in my opinion, unfair. The Germans bore equal guilt for World War I, not necessarily any more than anybody else. World War I, to make a long story short, was a fight that all sides had been spoiling for. Germany wanted to force the older colonial powers, Britain and France, to redraw the division of colonial territories. The British and French wanted to hang on to what they had. Germany certainly bore a portion of the war guilt, but not any more, in my opinion, than Germany or France. They were, however, the losers. And so they were obliged to assume guilt for the war. One of the aspects of the Versailles Treaty that was unfortunate and unfair, and which also had a direct bearing on the development of our century and the rise of fascism, was the fact that Germany was obliged to pay reparations to the victorious powers in World War I. Now, they were forced to get up of not only capital, but key areas of industrial land. For example, the Saar areas of the Ruhr district, one of the major industrial areas of Germany, were ceded to France, for example, as reparations for the French losses in World War I. This outraged the Germans. It also provided food for German reaction. German reactionaries of all stripes, ranging from the Stahlhelm to Hitler, were able to campaign very successfully against the Versailles reparations. It also created a situation that was ripe for manipulation by some of these Wall Street law firms, some of the lawyers who figure in them, and from the various industrial and financial concerns that they represented. By the way, we should remember that there are two basic divisions of capitalists, finance capitalists and industrial capitalists. The division is a fairly clear one. Finance capitalists are involved with financing industry, and industry is involved with the manufacturing of products. What happened in the 1920s was that Germany was complaining loudly about being unable to pay the reparations. The United States, already the dominant industrial and financial power on earth, was looking to influence the situation in Europe. And a state of affairs grew up in which a number of these very powerful Wall Street lawyers and law firms were able to not only make American political and diplomatic policy, but also transnational corporate and economic policy in the one fell swoop. The American Wall Street community, the Wall Street elite, had a lot of money to invest at this time. Germany was deemed to be a very promising investment climate. And so what a number of these prominent members of the American elite did was to wear two hats simultaneously, the hat of Wall Street corporate lawyer and also the hat of U.S. diplomatic representative at the same time. One of the principal figures in this was, again, John Foster Dulles, along with his brother Alan, one of the major partners in Sullivan and Cromwell. Two series of reparation loans were provided for, the Dawes and Young plans, and through these, Germany was able to borrow abroad almost as much money as they were paying out in reparations. So what Germany basically became in the 1920s was sort of a capital merry-go-round. Huge amounts of capital were paid out to the victorious powers under the provisions of the Versailles Treaty and the reparations payments, and at the same time, tremendous amounts of capital were loaned to Germany by American financial institutions. These were not only corporate securities, but municipal securities as well, that were floated through American financial institutions, and much of the legal work for these various securities programs and the hefty fees that derived from that were affected by some of these powerful Wall Street lawyers and law firms. Now, the special counsel, for example, to the Dawes Committee was John Foster Dulles. The law firm that he represented, Sullivan and Cromwell, was one of the major beneficiaries of these loan programs, and which basically enabled the German companies and German municipalities to float securities on the American capital market. The net effect of this capital merry-go-round in Germany was to lead to a concentration of industry. Three large cartels grew out of this pattern of this capital merry-go-round, so to speak. One of them, Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel, heavily capitalized by American industry. Another of these was AEG, Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, or German General Electric, 30%, by the way, owned by American General Electric at the time, an institution heavily capitalized by the Morgan Group. And the other one was IG Farben. Its full name was Interessengemeinschaft Farben Industry. This was the cartel that grew out of the German chemical and dyestuffs industries, one of the most important industrial concerns in the history of this or any other century. It's also a gruesome pun that frequently comes up and that I like to use in connection with the German dyestuffs. Farben is the German word for color, and indeed IG Farben patented many of the dyeing processes that were utilized for fabric processing and clothing in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. They became the backbone of German military industry in both World Wars, and in World War II, they manufactured the Zyklon B for the gas chamber. And they manufactured a different kind of dye stuffs as well, basically the stuff that would make you die. And they did that in a very, very big way. But it's worth noting that the many of these same Wall Street law firms handled the business for these German cartels. Sullivan and Cromwell, for example, handled all of the legal work for the American subsidiary of IG Farben, which was General Anilin and Film, or GAF. The partners of Sullivan and Cromwell, John Foster Dulles in particular, in their correspondence with officials of IG once Hitler came to power, actually opened their correspondence with IG Farben with the salutation Heil Hitler, to give you an idea of where some of these people's sentiments lay. And this is how John Foster Dulles, then later Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower, opened his correspondence with his German clients, with IG Farben. He opened his formal business letters with the greeting Heil Hitler. Should give you an idea of where this fellow was at. One of the major institutions that was utilized as one of the clearinghouses for these capital negotiations and for these capital operations was the Swiss-based Bank for International Settlements, or BIS. Remember that, because that's another of the names we're going to come back to. One of the companies that was heavily involved in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that we're talking about is ITT, or International Telephone and Telegraph. We're going to come back to that during the course of the discussion. It's worth noting that much of the German electrical grid in World War II and in the years running up to it was handled by IT&T. Most of the rest of it was handled either by Siemens, giant company, which is very much very active right here in the Valley today. And what wasn't handled by Siemens or IT&T was handled by AEG, German General Electric. A major German combat plane, the Focke-Wulf, one of their top tactical combat aircrafts, was manufactured by an ITT subsidiary, the Lorenz Company. And we're going to come back to ITT as well. One of the major Wall Street investment houses that was floating the German securities was Dillon Reed and Company. And remember that name, too, because we're going to come across people who were major investment bankers with Dillon Reed, and we're going to see how some of them figure prominently in the development, not only of the CIA, but in particular the shaping of the second half of the 20th century and the shaping of the national security state in particular. Bear in mind one of the names I floated earlier, another member of this powerful transatlantic financial and industrial axis, the name of Stinnes. That's STI. NNES. Not a name that a lot of people hear, but a very, very prominent name in 20th century capitalism, not only in the United States, but in Europe and elsewhere. This was the Stinnes family were international in their operations, and they had major concerns in many different countries, including and especially Germany and the United States. One member of the Stinnes family married into an American family and was teaching at Haverford College. That's one of these small elite institutions in Pennsylvania, along with Swarthmore and the little three, Amherst, Wesleyan, and Williams, some of the smaller of the American elite institutions along with the Ivy League. The Stinnes firm is going to figure very prominently in the course of the discussion this evening. And bear in mind, again, the term that I floated, the term networking, because we're going to see some of these names cropping up over a long period of time, and we're going to see them cropping up in connection with some of the most prominent, most important developments of the century. So again, the term networking, I think, is one of the names that we're going to want to remember. If you try to relate this to somebody and you talk about conspiracy, you know, people are going to roll their eyes and, oh, I don't believe in conspiracies, you know. But if you talk about networking, you catch their ear, whereas an awful lot of people will simply turn off. And indeed, networking is what we're looking at here. So again, in the 1920s, Germany is viewed as a very, very important investment opportunity for the American capital community. Germany is also deemed to be essential to be built up, and its industry in particular, to be built up as an anti-communist bulwark. This was already in the works in 1919 at the Treaty of Versailles and the Versailles Conference. Many of the old boys, many of the people that I'm going to be talking about, were already looking to do this at 1919. They began doing it in the 1920s as a result of the recapitalization of Germany under the Dawes and Young Plan, again with John Foster Dulles from Sullivan and Cromwell as senior counsel to the Dawes Committee. And again, it's worth understanding what was going on in Germany. We can think of Germany as kind of a capital merry-go-round. They're paying out huge amounts of capital in reparations payments. At the same time, they're borrowing huge amounts of capital abroad. And this capital distribution results in a concentration of economic power and the emergence of the three large German cartels, IG Farben, German General Electric, and Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel, that not only provide the backbone of German manufacturing in the pre-World War II and World War II periods, they also have much to do with the financing of the political rise of Adolf Hitler, IG Farben in particular. Another of the nexes, or a number of the connections, or one of the points of connection, where much of this networking goes on, and something that we should understand at this time period, is the U.S. Embassy in Moscow in the 1930s. Now, I realize we're jumping up a little bit at this point. We should bear in mind that after DeWitt Poole, who was the ambassador to Imperial Russia, broke off diplomatic relations, and after Woodrow Wilson's desire to have the fledgling Soviet Union incorporated in the family of nations, the Soviet Union remained largely a pariah nation. They were pretty much ridden out of the international community. One of the ironies of the rebuilding of German arms was that both Germany, because it was the loser in World War I, and the fledgling Soviet Union, because it was the first commie state, quote-unquote, were pariah nations, and there was a traditional pattern of cooperation between the Russian and German general staffs going back to von Bismarck. So much of the early rearmament of the German army took place inside of the Soviet Union. A third of the federal budget for the Weimar Republic went to a dummy corporation that was headed up by Colonel Walter Nikolai, the head of German military intelligence, and this was used to rebuild the German military secretly inside of the former Soviet Union. It's one of the reasons why neither Hitler nor Stalin trusted their own general staffs, because many of them, as junior officers, had worked with their opposite numbers in Germany and the Soviet Union, respectively. When Stalin purged his officers, for example, in the 1930s, something that didn't do the German military a whole lot, or the Russian military a whole lot of good, it has generally not been understood as to why he did it. It said that he was paranoid, which to a certain extent at least he was. But the fact of the matter is that there was a history of cooperation between the two general staffs. And in the early 1920s and mid-20s, the two military establishments had worked together very, very closely. And the irony is that both Hitler and Stalin were right. Both of their general staffs had been penetrated to a high level by spies from the other country. Stalin, for example, both of the dictators set up binary general staffs in order to counteract that. Hitler set up both the OKH and the OKW, Oberkommando der Heere and Oberkommando der Wehrmacht. And what Hitler did not know about specifically, but he guessed at, was that his office, general staff had been penetrated, which it had. There was a very famous World War II spy ring called the Lucy Ring. It communicated through Switzerland, but these were a group of German Democrats with a small d who saw the handwriting on the wall in the late teens and early 1920s, and they realized that Germany was going to become a dictatorship, and they infiltrated. They joined the German military and became and decided to work their way up as military professionals, all the while spying for the Soviet Union. They became generals, many of them, in the Wehrmacht, the whole time supplying intelligence to the former Soviet Union. Stalin, by the same token, also realized that he probably had spies on his general staff, and he was absolutely right. So he set up the Stavka, which was kind of a general staff within a general staff. One of the secrets to the Battle of Stalingrad, for example, was that Stalin had put together a huge reserve, which he didn't even tell most of his own generals about, because he had guessed that anything he told his own generals about would quickly be communicated to Hitler, and he was quite right. One of the things that boosted Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi Eastern Front spy chief that we'll hear more about later, and who became headed up what became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, The head of Oberkommando, or the head of Fremde Heer Ost, the German Eastern Front intelligence organization at the time, was a guy named Kinzel. And he was asked, as 1942 proceeded into the spring, he was asked whether he thought the Soviets had sufficient military reserves to counteract the German thrust into the Caucasus. Basically, after the Germans failed to knock the Soviet Union out of the war before the Russian winter came, they needed petroleum reserves to fight a protracted war of attrition. That was the reason that Hitler sent the 6th Army under General von Paulus, General Friedrich von Paulus, driving across in classic German blitzkrieg tactics to try to capture Stalingrad, which was the key to the Caucasus and the key to seizing the Caucasian oil fields, which were viewed as absolutely essential if Germany was going to prosecute a protracted industrial war and a war of attrition against the Soviet Union. However, before exposing this very large and elite German force to a possible flanking attack and before exposing it to encirclement, a possible encirclement and annihilation, which is what happened, the General Staff first consulted with their intelligence to see whether the Soviets might have sufficient reserves to spring a trap on the 6th Army. Well, Kinzel basically was unwilling to commit himself to saying that the Soviets no longer had any reserves. The party line had it within the Wehrmacht and the Nazi Party that the Soviets had already lost so much that they wouldn't be able to put together any significant amount of reserves. Kinzel would not toe the party line, and he said, well, basically, on the basis of what I've seen so far, it wouldn't surprise me if they did have reserves. They had they produced reserves in front of Moscow, which is why the Soviets won the Battle of Moscow. Galen, however, towed the party line, and Galen, as it turned out, was the goat of Stalingrad. He said, nah, the Soviets couldn't possibly have any additional reserves on top of what we've already been able to map out. This was because Stalin did not tell his own generals about the largest single unit that he had. I forgot, it was the 8th Guards Tank Army. Anyway, he had a force of some 2 million troops and 5,000 frontline battle tanks, the largest armored force ever assembled up to that point in military history, and the Germans did not know of its existence because Stalin did not tell his own generals about it because he figured they were penetrated. And then the Germans found out about this the hard way when it decimated the Romanian 3rd Army, cutting von Paulus's supply lines during the siege of Stalingrad, cutting off and annihilating the 6th Army and turning the course of World War II. But anyway, that's a bit of a digression. But it's interesting to note that this goes back to the period of military cooperation in the 1920s. And as a result, both of these dictators didn't trust their own generals. They didn't believe that their own general staffs were secure. And they were both right. They both were penetrated. And so they both set up binary general staffs. Now, U.S. Embassy in Moscow in the 1930s. We should remember that at this point the reaction in Germany was proceeding apace. Hitler was about to be appointed chancellor in the early 1930s. We should also remember that the same American industrialists and financiers who'd backed Hitler also were financing Mussolini at the same time and Mussolini's corporate state. Many of these same industrialists and financiers grouped around the House of Morgan tried to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt in 1934. Roosevelt had instituted the New Deal. This was seen as absolutely treasonous by much of the American elite. And they tried to overthrow Roosevelt and put together a fascist coup headed up by Smedley Butler, a Marine Corps Major General and two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Butler was a true conservative. He was very critical of Roosevelt. However, he was a genuine Democrat with a small d, and he was appalled that anyone would try to circumvent the constitutional authority, so he betrayed the conspirators to Roosevelt. There was a congressional committee put together to investigate this fascist coup, the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, named chaired by former Massachusetts representative and at one point Speaker of the House, John McCormick. This is one of those buried areas of history that you never hear about. When you're growing up in the United States, they don't teach you about the 34 coup attempt in the McCormick-Dickstein Committee because the names that attempted to install fascism were among the most prominent in American finance and industry. Names like Morgan, DuPont. The DuPonts, in addition to owning the DuPont Chemical Company, also were the owners of General Motors, a small automobile manufacturing concern. Gave them a fair amount of power. It's why you still to this day get your DuPont products with a General Motors car. It's because they basically were owned by the same folks. Henry Ford was one of Hitler's earliest and most prominent financial backers. To give you an idea of how much favor fascism was viewed with by many members of the American elite, Mussolini was made a member of the American Legion in 1935, although it was later rescinded because on a technicality that the American Legion did not award honorary memberships. The aforementioned Smedley Butler, right? Marine Corps Major General, two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor, In 1931, Butler gave a speech in which he denounced Mussolini. Mussolini had been touring the Italian countryside via motor car with Cornelius Vanderbilt, the American aristocrat and a member of the old robber baron Vanderbilt family from the 19th century. And as they were speeding through the Italian countryside, their car ran over and killed a young girl. Mussolini didn't even stop, just kept right on going. And according to the chauffeur's account, which appeared in the papers, he turned to Vanderbilt and said, "Don't look back, Vanderbilt. What's one life in the affairs of the state?" And when Smedley Butler commented on this publicly in 1931, he termed Mussolini, quote, "a wild, mad dog," unquote. For that, for calling Mussolini a wild, mad dog, because he wouldn't stop after running over a girl, a young girl, hitting and killing, basically being a hit-and-run driver, court-martial proceedings were initiated against Smedley Butler, although they were never brought to fruition, because Smedley Butler, as a young officer, had helped to relieve the American compound in China during the Boxer Rebellion. And Herbert Hoover, who was president at the time, was a young mining engineer in the American compound. And Smedley Butler, after relieving the siege of the American compound, went in and basically found Herbert Hoover cowering in a corner and crying and wetting his pants. And so this was bad public relations for the egotistical sitting president of the United States. So the court-martial proceedings were interdicted only because of the dirt that Smedley Butler had on Herbert Hoover. But it's worth noting that for calling Mussolini a wild, mad dog, a Marine Corps major general and two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor was facing a possible court-martial. And again, this is lost history and history that we don't hear, but it's worth understanding that. Now, I know one of the reasons that Roosevelt was viewed as a traitor to his class, and one of the reasons why the American elite wanted to overthrow Roosevelt, was that he established diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. After DeWitt Poole, again, one of the members of the American elite, an Ivy Leaguer, Princeton graduate, deeply involved with the Columbia faculty, as we'll see, a key OSS officer, major psychological warfare expert in the post-war and Cold War periods, there had been no diplomatic relations between the U.S. and the fledgling Soviet Union. Roosevelt saw this as completely impractical in light of the growing role of the Soviet Union in the world stage, so he established diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. Now, the people who were staffing the U.S. Embassy in Moscow at this time are key players, names we should understand, and we're going to see two of these names figuring in a big way in the post-World War II developments which were to shape the national security state. Now, again, bear in mind the name, the term networking here. It's a very important term. If you try to talk about this as conspiracy, people are going to come down and say, "Oh, I don't believe conspiracy." Call up KPFA and try to talk about this. Sir, we don't believe in conspiracy theories here. Try networking. You'll get a lot farther in relating this because networking is exactly what this is. Now, remember William Bullitt. He was the Philadelphia mainline elitist, Princeton graduate, who had attempted to further his own career by working out this agreement with Lenin. The agreement which would have reshaped which would have made a drastically different 20th century from the one we've gotten to know, did not go forward. William Bullitt basically went through a sort of a bohemian phase in the 1920s. He took up for a time with John Reed's widow. John Reed, the author of 10 Days That Shook the World, was hanging out in Greenwich Village Cafe and Bohemian Society for a while. But eventually, he saw the writing on the wall and he became a hardline, doctrinaire anti-communist. And surprise, surprise, he began to move up in the professional ranks. He became U.S. Ambassador to Moscow under Franklin Roosevelt, and he presided over a couple of very important names in the history of American national security operations in the 20th century. One of whom is a name that will be relatively familiar to people familiar with the history of the Cold War, that of George Kennan, K-E-N-N-A-N. He was a key State Department official with the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. He, at this point, also began networking, again that term, with a German diplomat named Gustav Hilger, last name H-I-L-G-E-R. Hilger became one of the prime architects of German Ostpolitik in the World War II period, and basically German policy towards the Slavic nations was to exterminate and enslave. The brutality with which the Nazis handled the East is not even understood at this point in history. The Slavs were viewed under Nazi ideology as being an inferior people. They were simply to be exterminated or enslaved. All Jews, all communists, all members of the intelligentsia of all of the Slavic nations were to be exterminated, and other members of the Slavic peoples were to be taught to count to nine and no farther, and to be taught to read only elemental instructions so that they could be used as crude laborers. One of the reasons, and there were many, many reasons that Eastern Europe remained behind the rest of the world, but among the many reasons was that in places like Poland, Virtually everybody was exterminated who had had a college education. Within 6 weeks of the Nazi invasion of Poland, the entire Polish intelligentsia had been liquidated on orders of the Nazis. There were no college professors, no civil engineers, no nothing, no surgeons, no nothing. And then you can imagine after Poland was retaken by the Red Army, and the whole countryside has been fought over by these two industrial armies. You got the cities are all ripped to hell, and there are shell craters and corpses buried in the rubble. There's no electrical grid, no sewage system. Imagine trying to rebuild a society that's been devastated by modern industrial warfare, and you have nobody with a college education, no doctors, you know, no civil engineers, no professors, no biologists, nobody. And it's one of the many reasons why that part of the world has lagged behind. And indeed, part of Nazi policy was to wreak so much devastation on their neighboring nations in terms of destroying their intelligentsia and also separating men and women. They put together labor battalions in which all able-bodied males were utilized as a labor force. Many of them were actually shipped to Germany. This also had the effect of separating men and women so that they would not produce a generation of military-age males when it was time to have another war. And it was the Germans in World War II were already looking to put into effect policies which would weaken the rest of Europe for their next go-round. They were looking to conquer Europe in a series of wars, and that's basically what they did. But one of the main German architects, of German policy toward the East was a von Ribbentrop, but Joachim von Ribbentrop was head of the German foreign ministry, named Gustav Hilger, H-I-L-G-E-R, and in this period of time, in the Moscow of the 1930s, he became very close to George Kennan, a key State Department official under William Bullitt in the U.S. Embassy in 1930s. Now, much of Bullitt's work, Bullitt was very, very busy and was not able to handle his workload. Much of his workload was handled by one of his top State Department aides in the U.S. Embassy, a guy named, and this is not a name that you hear very often, Carmel Offie, O-F-F-I-E. Later, we're going to see Offie, along with Frank Wisner, as one of the two major operators of something called the Office of Policy Coordination. Nominally a unit of the State Department, but in fact put together to coordinate CIA and military activities in connection with covert operations. Remember Carmel Offie? Because he became a prime mover and shaker in early U.S. intelligence operations. Eventually was the target of Joe McCarthy, among others, because Carmel Offie, in addition to his many other activities, was also a fairly upfront and above board homosexual. He was not a closet case, and this eventually drew the attention of and wrath of much of the American elite that we're talking about. It was, in the opinion of many, one of the reasons why Joe McCarthy singled out Carmel Offie, because he was so vulnerable for blackmail. Also, this is something I'm going to cite, indicates the different attitude that the American elite had towards sexuality. In many of the European elites, homosexuality was taken relatively for granted. And it wasn't endorsed, but it was simply viewed as part of life. To give you an idea the extent to which this was accepted, it's a marvelous anecdote about Winston Churchill in the pre-World War I period. He was a Tory MP, a conservative MP, and another Tory MP who was gay had been apparently fairly obvious in his seductions of sailors in Hyde Park, and this was creating something of a scandal. And so one Tory MP buttonholed Winston Churchill after a session of Parliament and said, you know, what are we going to do about so-and-so? And he goes, I've forgotten the guy's name. He goes, oh, yes, so-and-so. You mean the fellow who's giving buggery a bad name? So it was much more accepted in foreign society than it were in European society than in American society. But Carmel Offie had initially, was a very hardworking and very talented individual, was one of the rising stars of the State Department, became one of the prime movers and shakers of the early U.S. intelligence apparatus, and eventually became, along with Frank Wisner, the two main springs, would be a good way of putting it, of the Office of Policy Coordination. Later, at least in part because of his above-board homosexuality, Carmel Offie became a target of some of the McCarthyite purgers. But again, that term networking, remember some of the people who were at the U.S. Embassy or in and around the U.S. Embassy in Moscow in the 1930s, the names William Bullitt, who we saw in maneuvering at Versailles in 1919. But in particular, remember George Kennan and Carmel Offie and Gustav Hilger, because these are names that we're going to see a little bit later on as well. Now, as World War II developed. Obviously, the U.S. didn't come into World War II until December of 1941. The war had been going on for more than 2 years. William Donovan began jockeying early on for position with regard to what inevitably would be a U.S. intelligence apparatus that would take shape for the coming World War. And it's worth noting that in this regard, he was something of an Anglophile. William Donovan was undertaking a number of diplomatic missions to Europe while the war was on, passing on information on what was going on to Franklin Roosevelt, and he became very close to British intelligence in this period. It's worth noting that the OSS, in addition to its Wall Street influences, and we're going to take a look at those in a second, the OSS, that's the Office of Strategic Services, the World War II U.S. intelligence agency, which grew out of the Office of the Coordinator of Information, the COI or OCI. I've seen it both ways in the literature. That lasted for 11 months, eventually gave way to the OSS. But it's worth noting that a profound influence was wielded on the development of the OSS, not only by Wall Street, but by British intelligence, because Britain had been in the war for a couple of years. Britain had a standing peacetime intelligence agency, and a prominent and a very brilliant British industrialist named William Stevenson, codenamed Intrepid, was dispatched by William Churchill to the Americas to oversee all British intelligence operations in the Americas. In this regard, he took William Donovan on as something of a protege, which was interesting, because Donovan himself was an Irish-American. And there is no great love loss between the Irish-American and British communities. Yet Donovan himself became something of an Anglophile, and much of the early development of the U.S. intelligence apparatus was undertaken in cooperation with British intelligence. British intelligence put together what is arguably the first modern covert operations capability under the SOE, or Special Operations Executive. And the SOE had much to do with training developing the character of the OSS covert operations capability that was to operate in Europe during World War II. Now, in the OSS, which was headed up by William Donovan, a prominent Wall Street attorney. He was an assistant attorney general of the United States, actually oversaw the appointment of J. Edgar Hoover as head of the FBI while assistant attorney general, then also promptly clashed with Hoover, too. He never got along real well with Hoover. But the OSS was the direct predecessor of the CIA. It was the World War II U.S. intelligence agency headed up by prominent Wall Street lawyer William Wild Bill Donovan. This is the same Wild Bill Donovan who heads up the Fighting Harps, the Fighting 69th, as part of the Rainbow Division in World War I, develops a bitter rivalry with Douglas MacArthur because of that failed trap and disobeyed order that I spoke about earlier. He is then dispatched by J.P. Morgan to Europe in 1920 to reconnoiter the situation and also to kick, according to some sources, $1 million into German reaction. The fee that he got from that he used to found his own Wall Street law firm. William Donovan, Wall Street lawyer extraordinaire, is our first intelligence chief in World War II. He heads up the OSS. And many of the prominent names in post-World War II U.S. intelligence and the Central Intelligence Agency figure into OSS operations. One of the major players, and an individual we're going to look at in just a second, is Alan Dulles, who was assigned to the Bern, Switzerland office of the OSS. Now, Alan Dulles was, along with John Foster Dulles, one of the major partners in Sullivan and Cromwell. Again, that's the major Wall Street law firm that was handling much of the business for this transatlantic American and German financial and industrial axis. Alan's talents, by the way, what he brought to Sullivan and Cromwell was a talent for circumventing government regulations. In other words, the service that he could provide to his clients was getting around American law, circumventing American law. I think it's interesting, too, to observe his prominent role in the development of the CIA and to observe the extent to which Alan Dulles and other corporate lawyers imparted their characteristics to the nature of the CIA, because so much of what the CIA has done was illegal. And this was Alan Dulles' forte. It was viewed as what he really brought to Sullivan and Cromwell. He brought a knack for circumventing government regulations. And this was one of the things that made his services so appealing to Sullivan and Cromwell's clients. And again, Sullivan and Cromwell's sympathies were such that the Sullivan and Cromwell partners, such as John Foster Dulles, in their correspondence with I.G. Farben's officials, would open their correspondence with the salutation, Heil Hitler. Very interesting attitude. Other names that were to figure prominently prominently in U.S. intelligence and the CIA, Richard Helms. We're going to hear about him. He worked for the OSS, although he was also a naval officer. Frank Wisner, the aforementioned partner along with Harding Jackson and Carter Ledyard and Milburn. William Colby, he was a key OSS operative. He also went on to become a director of Central Intelligence. James Jesus Angleton went on to become the CIA's head of counterintelligence, also key OSS person. The OSS in many ways was the fount for the development of the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, another of these major nexuses, and I'm not sure if that's actually the proper conjugation. I don't know if nexuses or nexi would be plural of nexus. But anyway, it's not a word you hear a whole lot. But another one of these major power centers, how about that? That's a good way to get around it, is the Allen Dulles, Bern, Switzerland office of the OSS in World War II. Now, Allen Dulles, by the way, tabbed by fellow OSS officer and later Justice of the Supreme Court, Arthur Goldberg, an American traitor, unquote. That's exactly how Goldberg termed him. Allen Dulles was assigned by the OSS to operate in the Bern, Switzerland office. Now, Switzerland was a very interesting country. Actually, it was sort of a company. That was an interesting Freudian slip, because in many ways, Switzerland, although nominally neutral, was serving as a financial clearinghouse for not only Nazi Germany, but for some of these same transatlantic financial and industrial axes that were operating throughout the course of World War II. Many of these cartel agreements and many of these capital arrangements between companies that were respectively based in countries that were at war, they remained in operation throughout the course of World War II. For example, Standard Oil, that is a Rockefeller property. A lot of people don't know about the old Standard Oil Trust. It's a bit of a digression, but Standard Oil had a virtual monopoly on petroleum in this country. Then Teddy Roosevelt came up with the trust-busting scheme. It was actually a scam. It was deemed immoral to have one single company dominating a single market, as Standard Oil did. So what they did was laws were passed to break up these companies into a lot of different companies. But nobody said that they couldn't all be owned by the same people, which is what happened. So they busted up Standard Oil. What they busted it up into was Standard Oil of New Jersey, later Esso, now Exxon. That's Standard Oil of New Jersey. They busted it up into Standard Oil Company of New York, which became Saucony Vacuum, later Saucony Mobile, now Mobil. That's Standard Oil of New York. Standard Oil of California, which is Chevron. Standard Oil of Texas, which is Texaco. Standard Oil of Indiana, which is Amoco. Standard Oil of Ohio, which is Sohio. All owned by the Rockefellers. It was basically an okey-doke. And they said, okay, we're not going to have one company owning an entire industry. That's scandalous. But you could have a whole bunch of companies all owned by the same people, which is the same bloody damn thing, which is what they did. But no Standard Oil tanker was ever torpedoed in World War II, because Standard Oil was doing business with Nazi Germany the entire time. And no Standard Oil tanker was torpedoed in World War II, because the Nazis knew where the oil was going. They had an agreement with the Rockefellers. One of the most grotesque of these agreements that went on throughout the course of World War II, by the way, it was not just our industrialists and financiers who did this stuff. Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, is portrayed as being duped by Hitler at Munich, right? You know, the cunning, wily Adolf Hitler duped, you know, the naive, unseeing British aristocrat Chamberlain, right? Bull. That is not what happened at all. In fact, Neville Chamberlain was very consciously marching Adolf Hitler and the Nazis eastward so that they would go against the Soviet Union. He wasn't duped by Adolf Hitler at all. They knew exactly what they were doing. Neville Chamberlain was the protege of Sir Montague Norman, who was the head of the Bank of England and who funded Hitler directly from the Bank of England, because there were plenty of British industrialists, such as the Clevedon set, who were also pro-Hitler and pro-fascist.